I saw a fly.
Ah, it's really big. It's really big.
Is it going to be like that episode from Breaking Bad with the fly?
Oh, that's the worst one, isn't it?
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Prog and Progeny. As you can see, we're raring to go here. Well, I'm actually suffering a bit. How are you, Tallulah?
I'm fine. I'm not ill.
No, I had a... Because I'm 65, officially old, I get invited for a shingles jab.
Oh,
yeah, that fly's huge. It's like
I'm
a
gonna
B-2
try and get
bomber.
It out one sec.
Yeah, while you kill the fly, I'll keep talking. Yeah, I got invited for a shingles jab, which has kind of made me feel a bit shitty, really. But never mind. I've got my Superman T-shirt on. I'm not feeling very super, but hurry up and kill the fly, Tallulah, so we can get on with this. Have you got one of those electronic zapper things? Or are you just going to use an old-fashioned magazine? A copy of Tatler or Vogue or something?
Oh, I don't think I'm going to be able to. It's quite slow. So there's loads of FAC stuff.
So let's explain what the FAC is and what.
But obviously David Stops is coming on, so we can talk to him about quite a lot of that as well.
That's true, actually. Yeah, we've invited David, who features in the book a little bit at the very beginning, when we asked him to manage us, and then fired him about 5 weeks later. But luckily, he doesn't hold a grudge, so we stayed friends. Although I didn't see him for a long time, but then. In about 2009, he called me up and asked me if I wanted to be a member of the Featured Artist Coalition, and I foolishly agreed that I would. It seemed very exciting at the time to be part of this artist movement. Yeah, it was.
And you were CEO.
I was CEO, along with Crispin Hunt, who was the lead singer from the Long Pigs. Do you remember the Long Pigs? No. They're good, actually. They had an album called The Sun Is Often Out or something like that, and another one called Mobile Home. Anyway, they were good. Crispin's a good songwriter, and I liked his voice. But getting off track here. The Featured Artists Coalition. So David was involved as a manager of Howard Jones. David invited me to join, but then he kind of was like, but we want you to be on the board as well. So... and it was all very exciting because we had all people like Annie Lennox and Robbie Williams and David Rowntree from Blur and Ed O'Brien from Radiohead and Fran Healy
Billy
from
Bragg.
Travis, Billy Bragg, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, a bunch of well-known people, all feeling like we needed to form an organization, not really a union because it's more about... artists' rights, really, rather than working conditions. They've got the musicians' union for orchestra players and session musicians, but there was nothing for what they call the featured artists, which is basically the person or the band whose name appear on the records rather than the session players, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why we called it the Featured Artist Coalition.
And you were kind of an inspiration to lots of artists because of crowdfunding.
I suppose maybe that's why David Stops originally asked me. Well, we can ask him himself next time. Why he thought I would be a good person to join? Because he didn't. I don't think he approached the rest of the band. So I got involved.
Fly again.
Oh God!
It is like Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
This is not sanitary.
We can't cook here. So it was very exciting at the beginning. As soon as I got involved, I realized that, because it kind of started a little bit before my involvement. So they had this music managers forum, which is basically an organization that the music managers were all in. And we'd had a run-in with them previously when they invited us to perform, when they gave Rod Smallwood, Iron Maiden's manager, the Peter Grant Award, which they did this awards for each, you know, it's all mutual backslapping. Anyway, the managers helped get the Featured Artists Coalition started. PPL basically put up the money, about £500,000 for the Featured Artists Coalition to get started, using performers' money, which was not, which hadn't been able to have been allocated or distributed. So with the idea that the FAC, because they thought it was a good cause, they thought it was a good thing to get going because it represents artists.
Whose performers' money was it?
So basically, PPL collects. So every time a record's played on the radio or in any sort of public performance of music, there's a royalty paid, or you have a license. So if you want to play, let's say you're a hairdresser and you want to play music in your hairdresser's shop, which is public broadcast of music effectively, you have to buy a license. So quite a lot of the money it's like a few hundred pounds a year. It's not really expensive or anything. Quite a lot of the money they collect, they can't attribute to any particular artist because it's kind of what they would call a black box payment, you know. It's just a general payment for general use of music. So they tended to have quite a lot of money that they couldn't distribute easily. So they would kind of divvy it up pro rata between the record companies and the artists. Anyway, bottom line is they had a few million quid sitting around. And so they said, okay, well, this is performers' money. Let's put some of it to a good use and lend it. They lent it to the Featured Artists Coalition to get them going. But then the managers, especially Jazz Summers, who's now dead, so I can say bad things about him, who used to co-manage Wham and a few other people, they basically pissed the money away. By the time I got involved, most of the money was gone. They spent like £160,000 on a PR company for the launch, and just a total waste.
Why?
Of the why exactly? I don't know. You know, they basically, as I said, pissed the money away. So almost immediately, when it really got started, we were broke, and we shouldn't have been. And then we had to try and raise money to pay for somebody to run the office. And so it was kind of the whole thing was a bit of a drag, really. Whilst it was a great idea, certainly at the start, it was poorly executed and badly run. And then, that all culminated in me and Crispin, who we kind of decided to be, we were like the co-CEOs of the thing, but it was just, it felt like it was going nowhere. They were getting funding from people like Google and Spotify, which were not on our side at all.
No.
So
it's a bit corrupt.
I was just totally disillusioned by the whole thing, as was Crispin, and we both resigned. So that was that.
You said there was also like kind of inner politics or internal struggles or something.
Yeah, there was a bit of a internal struggle between a few of the performers. I'm not going to name any names because it's not really fair.
Well,
I can name somebody that you know, actually.
Yeah, I could bleep their name.
Okay, well, you know who I'm talking about, right?
That's unsurprising.
Yeah. So yeah, it was just, you know, it was just not what you needed, really. Whilst there was trying to do some good things as well, you know, for artists. So, but they're still going. And I think it's much more professional these days than it was back then. So that was I was with them for about 5 years. I think I quit in about 2015.
You're not keen to get involved again?
It's a lot of work and a lot of time. And I kind of felt like, you know what? A lot of artists really don't give a damn, you know? They just, maybe it's because they just want to get on with their careers and they don't have the time for it. But you do feel like you're trying to help people who don't want to be helped. That's the first thing.
It is important though. Like, I mean, we talk a lot on the podcast about how you, and you're quite switched on, were taken advantage of massively at a young age by record companies and managers. And if you're a musician who doesn't understand how it works and you're just desperate for a record deal, you know, who's looking out for you?
But, you know, so just to give you an idea, yeah, that's true. But so, basically, the artists that are really successful, I'm not going to say all of them, but most of them kind of pull up the rope behind them. You know, they don't help up and coming artists, and they certainly don't give them information that would be useful to them. So, for example, when I was, one of the things I thought about was we were signed to EMI. In fact, we were no longer with EMI, but our royalty, we were still being paid royalties by EMI. Oh, sugar. It's Delilah. Where was I? So yeah, the thing I realized, I'm in the Feature Artists Coalition. I've learned stuff about how things work a lot more than I knew before about royalties and copyright. And the big burning issue back then was the fact that people streaming. Like us, well, it wasn't even streaming because Spotify
downloads.
Didn't... Downloads. Yeah, Spotify didn't even start until 2009. I was one of the first people to join Spotify. Did you get that thing when it shows you your the first ever song you played on Spotify?
Yeah. Yeah. Guess
mine
what
was,
it was.
Yeah, September 2009. What was yours?
Mine was 2014, I think. But that's
right.
Presumably
sounds
when
about
I
got right,
an
yeah.
Account. Yeah. Yeah. Guess what it was.
Go on.
No, guess.
Okay. Was it?
It was by a particular artist that I was a big, big fan of.
Oh, was it? Was it? Was it Hannah Montana?
Yeah. It was actually. It was a Miley Cyrus song. It was Miley Cyrus, and it was actually Miley Cyrus, not Hannah Montana, because I think I'd matured past Hannah Montana. But it was still
okay.
Miley Cyrus.
Well, surprisingly, my first song was. Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden or something like that. It was an Iron Maiden song. I never listened to Iron Maiden, so I don't know why it was that. yeah. Oh, no, I think it was The Number of the Beast. Anyway, Iron Maiden.
Right.
And I swear, I just don't listen to Iron Maiden, so I don't know why it was that. But anyway, we're really getting off topic now. So EMI were just paying us royalties from our records and record sales, CD sales mainly, and the streams, but they were deducting the same deductions that they would from physical product, you know, like packaging deductions of like 20%. And, you know, just, it was basically, they were paying us the same royalty on streaming and downloads as they were on records and CDs. And with my new FAC experience, I was thinking, this just isn't right. They shouldn't be, you know. And so, and then I started asking people to help me with, you know, putting together like a case, you know. And I remember talking to Pink Floyd's manager, probably got his contact through Nick Mason, and they wouldn't tell me what their deal was or what I could expect to get from EMI, because they were with the EMI as well. So, you know, I was trying to figure out what I could expect. And they basically said, well, I can tell you that we get the same royalties for downloads as we do for physical product. I'm like, yeah, but you probably renegotiated your contract and you're getting a great royalty rate for both, you know? So kind of what the point I'm making is people weren't very helpful.
No, because it's so, like this NDA is everywhere.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So
the record companies found ways to get around it, basically.
Well, so what happened was I then found out about Guy Vickers, who co-wrote the Marathon album. He wrote the lyrics for it. But before that...
Would he want to come on?
We could ask him on. He was a Marillion fan, but the problem is he would be very unsure about talking about the contracts and the negotiations
that
he had.
But just generally
your
friendship and...
Whereas I'm quite happy to talk about it. Fuck the NDA as far as I'm concerned. I really don't care.
I don't know, that's how NDAs work.
I know, but what are they going to do? Take me to court. I hear prison food's quite nice. anyway, he told me that Guy was a barrister. So I collared him one day at a gig. And anyway, we cut a long story short. We had a meeting and he, although he didn't really know much about the music industry, he was a barrister that dealt in contracts, you know. So this was a contract thing, but it wasn't, you know. So together we kind of learned the whole process of what was going on, and I'd written to EMI to say that you shouldn't be selling our music as downloads because we don't have a contract with you for that. It's just for records, you know.
And they said, fuck off.
They said, well, no, they're digital records. It's like they make up their own language. So because it's not the same as selling a physical product, a record. Technically speaking, they are licensing you the right to listen to it, rather than you're not owning it, you're not buying anything. It's a license. A subscription with Spotify is not, you're not buying a product. You're just getting the right to listen to stuff. So it is a different thing. So that was our argument. So we managed to get the rest of the band on board. And I didn't mention any of this in the book, but our biggest problem was money, because to take a record company on, you need a shitload of money, So the biggest obstacle to a small, broke artist taking their record company to court is the cost. You need to pay for a solicitor. And then when you get to court, the barrister argues the case. So you have a solicitor that has to prepare the case, and the barrister argues it in court. And it was going to be expensive, because there was a lot of stuff to get through, a lot of negotiations and all the rest of it. So what we did, it was possible to have what's called a after-the-event insurance. So it sounds really crazy, but what happens is an insurance company will give you an insurance policy that if you lose, they will pay your costs and the other side's costs, right?
What?
And all you have to do, you don't have to pay them anything in advance, but if you win in the settlement, you have to get their fee. So basically you say to the other side, and you have to disclose this to the other side. So we go to EMI and we say, look, we've got this insurance policy, and in this insurance policy, for us to settle the court case with you, we have to pay them a large sum of money. And that's going to come out of our settlement with you. If we lose in court, they will pay you, they will pay what the court orders, because you end up having to pay the other side's costs. So effectively what it meant was, so we could go to court with no risk, because the insurance policy would cover us up to £500,000 worth of costs, which is quite a lot, right?
Yeah.
The other side would look at that and go, okay, we know that we can't just basically run the bill up.
Bully them into not going.
Exactly, yeah. Which is what they tried to do. They tried to run the bill up above £500,000 to scare us off. So they basically hired big solicitors and spent a lot of money, and they were real bastards. Yeah. Well, yeah, we were, at that point, we were just like, no, we're in now. We have to keep going, right? So then we got...
This is 2009.
No, it started in 2012. I think the court, we got to the point where we were about to go to court around about 2014, I think it was, 14 or 15. So it took a couple of years.
And wasn't Fish helping you with this too?
Yeah, we needed Fish on board, because the contracts were with him as well, and Mick Pointer as well, because he was on the first contract. And we needed them to be part of the case, and Mick didn't want to do it. I said, we had to basically write him a letter saying that we basically indemnify him from any responsibility for paying any costs or any settlement if should we lose. So he basically said, I'll put my name to it, but I don't want to have anything to do with the...
It's fair enough.
Which is kind of, so that's what we did with Mick. And so we get to the point where we're about to go to court, and they say we should have a mediation, a negotiation day, We started about 10 o'clock in the morning. So we go in there with us and Guy, and they come in there with their big shot lawyers. And by then it wasn't EMI anymore. EMI had gone bust, and Warner Music had bought the EMI catalog that we were part of. So we were now fighting Warner's, not EMI. So we get to this meeting, 10 o'clock in the morning, and within the first hour of negotiations, they basically agreed to quite a lot of the things that we wanted. And we were like, this is going great. They were basically folding, it felt like, But there was a major point that they wouldn't give in on. And we negotiated with them all day till 10 o'clock at night. We were there for like 12 hours of negotiating. We were absolutely worn out. Everybody was just wanted to go home, And the rest of the band were like, we should just take it, And I was saying to Guy, we should just tell them to piss off. Let's go to court, because, if we win in court, the terms of our settlement in court will be public, so other bands will be able to see what we got. Whereas if we agree to their terms and sign the NDA, then nobody will ever know about it and nobody can benefit from it. And me being as part of the Featured Artist Coalition was fighting for artists' rights and all that. And Guy basically just said, look, as your barrister, it's my duty to say to you, you cannot think about other people. You have to just think about what's good for you today in this situation. And I think you should take the settlement, you know. It was definitely the sensible thing to do, because had we gone to court, we might not have won. Part of the agreement to do with the insurance policy was that Guy had to write a letter to the insurance company telling them what his professional estimation of our chances of winning were, because obviously they're not going to give us the insurance policy if they don't think we've got a good chance of winning.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had to say truthfully what he thought our chances were. And
what did you think they were?
I think he said 60%. And I said, that doesn't sound very good. He said, for a barrister, he said, that's really good. He said, because you just don't know in court. You just don't know how it's going to go. If you say 60% chance of winning, you're pretty confident, you know?
If it had gone to court, would it have been a judge or a jury or
I don't think there would have been a jury. I'm not sure. That's a good point, actually. But yeah, it was horribly nerve-wracking. And then I had one sleepless night when at the very early stage of the whole thing, when we served them the writ, you know, to say we're suing you, their response was to come back and say, you don't have standing, which basically means that you don't have the legal standing to take this case, because the Marillion contracts with EMI are between EMI and Marillion Limited, which no longer exists. And we were like, what? And so what happened back in the 80s?
Yeah, I didn't understand any of this in the book.
Yeah, so back in the 80s, we had Misplaced Childhood, we were successful. And then just like Chris Kimsey was doing his tax year out by working in Berlin and places like that, which basically means you stay out of the country for a year and then all the money you earn in that year, you don't have to pay any tax on because you're not living in the UK. So it's basically a way of avoiding tax. So Fish decided, I'm going to do a tax year out. But we didn't want to do that. So we had to separate our affairs. And the way they did that was they set up a company called Marillion Limited, a company called Marillion Overseas Limited, and five individual companies that each member of the band had. So Ian's was called Lenders a Quid Limited. And Pete's was called Low Key Limited. Fish's was called Windswept Thumb Limited. Steve Rotheridge's was called Raven Scar Limited. And mine was called Fennig Limited, because that's what...
Irish.
No, Pfennig is German for penny, which is the German coin, like a mark and a penny. Marks and Pfennigs, you know. It's what the German engineer on Misplaced Childhood used to call me, Pfennig. That was his nickname.
Lend us a penny, Limited.
Lend us a quid. And he spelt it like a Latin, LENDUSAQUID, like aquid. Lend us aquid.
Lend us aquid.
So anyway, so we had all these companies set up with the idea that our affairs would be separate from Fish. So should Fish decide to do his tax year out, he could do it successfully with the rest of us being able to stay in the UK. So it never happened. He never did the tax year out. He left the band. And then in 1990, we had these new accountants and they said, why have you got all these limited companies? It's ridiculous setup you've got here. It's a waste of money. Let's just close them all down and set you up as a partnership. So that's what we did. But what nobody realized, we had no idea. The accountant didn't spot it, and John was probably drunk. We basically assigned all of our contracts to the companies. So the contracts were now between the companies and the record company. So we liquidated all the companies, but EMI carried on paying us, and nobody thought anything of it until we started this lawsuit against them.
How did you get around that then?
Well, this is why I had a sleepless night, because I was like, when we got this letter from EMI, I'm looking at it thinking, what? So they don't even have to pay us anything because we don't have a contract with them. And the company was closed down. These companies were all struck off, they say, struck off 20 years before. So we go and do some research, And it turns out that you can get a company resurrected from the dead, basically, if you have a good reason.
Yeah. But
the absolute limit from which you can never bring the company back to life is 20 years. And we were 3 months before 20 years was up.
So we
did an emergency application to the court. And I remember being a guy standing in this court with this judge and him saying, explaining why we needed to revive the companies. And just so that we could reassign the contracts back to us as individuals. And he granted us like a month. He said, you can revive the companies, but as soon as you've reassigned, they mustn't do any trading. And then you have to kill them again afterwards. So that's what we did. So yeah, it was pretty scary.
God.
Anyway, then it was game on again. We were back into went back to EMI and said,
what would have happened if you couldn't reassign the companies?
Well, what would happen is the royalties, any money that's been owed to companies that no longer exist gets paid to the crown. So the queen would have got our royalties.
Oh my God, the queen would have got my royalties technically, because when you die, they're mine.
That's a bit mean to say that to Lula.
No, they are though, aren't they?
you and your siblings, yes.
Yeah, well, five of them, four of them.
My God, I'm only 65. Easy up. So in the end, on that day at 10 o'clock at night, we agreed at terms with Warner's, our new record company, and the upshot of it was that we did get an improved deal, and we also agreed that we would do reissues of all the albums, which we've been doing ever since. We've finished all the Warner's ones now. The next one to come out is Meridian.com, which we own the rights to. So that's a different situation. But so it was actually beneficial for both them and us that we renegotiated. But we had to, to get into a position to renegotiate, we had to threaten to take them to court. That's the crazy thing about it. It's really horrible.
And you can't talk about it. Well, you just have in quite a lot of
detail.
I've
talked about it, but I haven't said anything about what's in the deal. So
no. That final point that they wouldn't budge on, could you tell us what that is or no?
It was to do with the royalty rate that they would pay us for digital, basically.
And are you happy with what you got?
It can always be better, but it was better than we had, put it like that.
Do you wish, in hindsight, after seeing how successful Spotify has been, etc., that you'd taken them to court?
You know what? I don't, actually, because I think it would have been horribly stressful. I think we would have won, but imagine if we'd lost on some technicality, So we just thought, we definitely need to renegotiate because we were being screwed,
as
were a lot of artists.
And FSC was trying to do too.
And you can tell it's true because the sort of deals that people were subsequently signing, new artists were getting much better rates on streaming, for example, than the sorts of rates that legacy artists like us were being paid because of our old deals. So it's, and then since then, some record companies have basically said, oh, we're going to pay a minimum rate, royalty rate of, 15, 20%, whatever it is, to all our artists, because they know that some of the really old artists are on like 9 or 10%, which is just criminal.
What percent are you on now?
I can't say. It's part of the NDA.
You can't
say? No. So
it's all this fuck the NDA. You can tell me.
Yeah. No, I can't.
It was crap.
Well, you consider that there's no manufacturing costs, no marketing costs. They don't do anything and they just collect. Yeah.
That's horrific. That's so wrong.
Exactly. So anyway, by the end of it all, with my fed up with dealing with record companies, fed up with the FAC. Yeah, so I kind of just had enough of all that side of things, to be honest. And I just wanted to get back into being a musician again.
Love
so
you.
It took over a lot of my time, especially I was on the board of PPL as well. So that was the other thing for about 10 years, 12 years.
Yeah, I must say I was very impressed. I didn't really know any of this. I was really impressed.
Oh, thank you. So that was, again, that was another thing that took up a lot of time and was a steep learning curve. But, I kind of enjoyed it. You know, it was going to London for board meetings and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, and you met some cool people through it.
I did, yeah.
When I was reading this, I thought that PPL, I first read it as standing for Pornographic Performance Limited. You could tell I was skim reading it because you also talked about how you bought an organ that the band didn't like and you sold it to John Mitchell, but I read it as Joni, unsuspecting prog fan John Mitchell. I thought it was Joni Mitchell.
John Mitchell, he's played with quite a lot of prog bands. He's a guitar player and he does his own stuff as well. I felt sorry for John. At the time I was kind of laughing about the fact that he bought this pipe organ off me and, you know, cause it was a bit of a liability. It was only £200. It's what I paid for it. He paid me to, I basically said, pay me what I paid for it and it's yours. And he was like, yeah, great. And he sent somebody around to pick it up, but it was huge. And the pipes were made of like a lead.
It was a proper organ, church organ. Yeah,
metal pipes, you know. Some of them were like 8 foot long, you know. And it weighed a ton. They were made of lead. Lead tin alloy, I think the pipes are made of. So they're really heavy.
It's very healthy.
No. And it was a bugger to tune because you had to kind of bend the metal at the top of the pipe and try and to change the length of the pipe. Yeah, it was crazy. And it took up a lot of space at the racket club. So the rest of the band were really annoyed about it. Kind of blocked out all the light, you know. And I couldn't...
Ding, I, dun, 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 I, dun, dun.
And I couldn't really get it in tune properly. So I ended up sampling it and then tuning the samples to be in tune. So I kind of got use of it anyway. But
you bought that because you were all doing an acoustic... remastering, right?
That's right. We did an album called Less Is More, and it was kind of an acoustic reimagining of our songs. And it was this.
Is that popular?
Steve H tells this story about this Dutch fan who came up to him and he said, "I'm talking to you about your album Less Is More. For me, less really isn't more."
So no, it wasn't popular.
No, it was. I think some people really liked it. I think it was good. It was good. It was fun to do.
What songs were on it?
Oh, we did about 10 or 15 different songs. Now you got me. You're trying to make me remember them. There's a whole bunch of stuff on there that are all different to the original versions because it's all acoustic. And... like we did a version of Go, Interior Lulu, Out of This World, Wrapped Up in Time, The Space, Hard as Love, Quartz, and so on. And there's a track that was not released on anything else called It's Not Your Fault. So, and it did all right, actually. We did a little acoustic tour. We did a gig at the Cadogan Hall in London and filmed it and put that out. And that was, am I boring you? And that was... That was very well received. That live gig was very well received from that tour. So, yeah, I think it was, for what it was a success.
But you said that after that you were feeling no creative impulse whatsoever.
Well, it was kind of, the reason we did it was because we felt we'd kind of scraped the barrel dry and we didn't really have anything new to record. So it was like, okay, let's do a, it was in 2009 and we thought, let's do an acoustic album as a stopgap, you know.
Yeah, you jump about a bit in this chapter because it's like 2012, 2009.
Yeah. I don't know what happened. We just went through a kind of a lean phase in writing. We were struggling, I think, to be creative and come up with new stuff. And that track, the one track that was... brand new, It's Not Your Fault, was written a few years previously when we were working on Happiness Is the Road, I think. So, and then as we got towards the end of the chapter, we decided to go away to Portugal, to Lissada, to this country house. It was kind of a little hotel, really, with a restaurant. And the restaurant, we cleared all the tables and chairs out of there and set up as a band to try and write some music. And I was training for my first marathon. I remember I did a lot of running, like running 20 miles through the Portuguese countryside.
Wow.
But as I tell in the book, H didn't come out to start with because his wife Lynetta wasn't well. And then when he finally did join us, we had a bit of a moment.
Yeah. So you guys were all there, the four of you, and you got into, like, you were writing very proggy music. You described it as the type of music that makes you want to wear a cape.
I was just being silly. we were just having fun, you know, just enjoying ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
And it probably wasn't the most inspiring for a singer to try and sing over, you know. So
right.
When H2H turned up, he was kind of, I think he wasn't really in a great mood to start with because he had been dragged away from home and, you know, his wife not being well. And so he, and we'd had this, as we always do, you know, talked about him because he wasn't there, you know.
You said whenever one person's not in the room, you'll talk about each other.
You can imagine with the five of us.
Does it still happen now?
Of course it does, you know. Always, yeah, you know, and usually we're just taking the piss out of each other, you know, laughing about something that's happened, or it's all good humoured fun, really. And I'm sure that they do the same to me.
But this time you were saying how you didn't like one of his lyrics.
Yeah, and everybody agreed. That was the thing. I do remember it, yeah. And it hasn't resurfaced since. And it just didn't feel right for Marillion. And it was fairly harmless. It wasn't like it was offensive or anything like that. It just didn't feel like a Marillion lyric. I don't know why, but everybody was like, oh, not really sure about that one, you know. And then it was like, well, somebody needs to say something, or he'll just keep using, just keep trying it until he finds a home for it. And then if he sings it on, you know, a really great piece of music, we're going to be stuck with it, right? It's best that somebody says something. That was the kind of conversation.
It feels like a big deal being made out of not a big deal.
Exactly. But my timing was terrible. So he basically said, oh, this is rubbish, this music. So I kind of was like, yeah, well, nobody really likes that lyric of yours either, you know, kind of.
No, I've got it here. Crap. I'll tell you what's crap.
I didn't really say that, but you know what I mean? I kind of used it as an opportunity to complain about his lyric that we didn't like and that everybody had said that they weren't keen on. So,
did you dob everyone else in?
I think I might have done, yeah. Whilst everybody's going like this, you know. but H just left and never came back for the rest of this. Well, he might have done towards the end because we had to rehearse for this acoustic show that we had planned at the end of the week. So it was a complete disaster, basically. I was so tactless. And had I mentioned it under better circumstances, I'm sure he would have taken it much better and it wouldn't have been a problem. And as I've said, these days, you know, it just doesn't happen. You know, we haven't had a similar situation at all like that. So, I don't know. It was just the timing, state of mind of people at the time, me included probably. I don't know. But we just all went home, everybody in a bad mood, bit of a downer in the whole session, really. I don't even remember if we ended up writing any songs or not. I don't think we did.
Waste of money.
And then we kind of didn't really speak for about 6 months, because I think it wasn't like we weren't talking, but it was just like nobody said, should we go back in the studio and start working on the next album? We kind of just...
So you basically had a six-month break.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't know what... I can't even remember what I did. I was probably getting stuck into... It was 2010, so I was busy with it, the PPL, the FAC. I probably was quite happy keeping myself busy doing all that stuff, you know?
But you weren't earning anything doing that stuff.
No, it was... I got paid...
Did Lucy not, or like Mike, did they not think it was important that you get back to work?
Well, what ended up happening was we had to get back to together to rehearse for a tour that was coming up at the end of the year. So we did, but it was like we just turned up and started rehearsing, and nobody really discussed what had happened in Portugal.
So weird. You just had it on like a 6 month holiday, like.
Yeah, and then we started working on Sounds That Can't Be Made, which was the next album, which came out in 2012.
Yeah, which was a really good album. But that would not happen in a normal job.
In a normal job, no, you wouldn't be able to just do that.
I've had a disagreement with a colleague. I'm just going to not come to work for 6 months.
But,
I just
need
a break.
But you have to think about it. Being able to do that means that it's a way of getting rid of what could end up being.
I think it's healthy that you did do that, but it's weird that it just happened naturally.
But people, you can imagine this sort of thing happens in bands where people say something. People get very, very precious about their creative output, you know, very protective of it. And it can feel very insulting if somebody puts down something that you've created. So whether it's a piece of music or a lyric or a song, whatever, you know, you bring something to that. And if somebody says, oh, that's not very good, it kind of hurts, doesn't it? So I understand why he was as upset as he was. And, you know, I shouldn't have said it like I did, you know. So you can see how with a different group of people, that could lead to a breakup that never recovers, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we've got better at being more charitable. Or as H used to say, you know, the most important thing that keeps us together is forgiveness, right?
So, yeah.
Because we all say stuff that maybe shouldn't be said, you know?
Yeah.
I think H is more vocal about stuff, and so am I. We're probably the two most outspoken in that sense. Although Ian and Steve have their moments.
Do you think their opinions are respected more?
Why? Because they're not as vocal about it.
Yeah, just maybe they like say it in a better way.
Yeah, I think Steve Rothery is probably more tactful than anybody else in the band.
Yeah.
I'm probably the least tactful. Not always. I sometimes, you know, I remember, I don't know if I told this story about Mike Hunter. Because I didn't know this, but I had the reputation for being the person that sacks people. I remember I've sacked a few people over the years. I won't name them.
You have named them in the podcast.
Have I? Yeah. I remember I sacked a couple of people that ran the fan club once. And
are you allowed to do that?
Well, yeah. I went round to their house and collected all the stuff that they had, all the magazines and everything. And fired them. That was so. I kind of had this reputation for it's not nice. I mean, I didn't enjoy it at all. Anyway, I don't know why I get these jobs, but Mike Hunter had heard that was my reputation. You know, that I was the axe man. You know, and then he said one day, Ian said to him, Mike, Mark wants to have a word with you, and he was like, oh no, they're going to fire me. It wasn't. He was expecting that I was going to tell him he was fired, and it was just funny. Nothing. It was nothing. It was completely, you know, something innocuous.
Yeah,
I was horrified that he thought that.
That's so funny.
Mike, come into my office. I want a word. He's like,
I can't really imagine you having that reputation. I mean, I can and I can't.
No, that's what I thought. Yeah, I'm not like that.
You can be a bit scary. When you're angry. Dad makes, I don't know if I should say this, he makes waiters and waitresses cry quite a lot. So.
Well, if they'll do their job properly, then I wouldn't do it.
Oh my God.
I have to say,
anyway.
I'm just saying, my children take me to task for being, what's the word? Not mean, but just...
You should never, ever be rude to anyone who works in hospitality. It's already a really hard job. You should be really grateful and kind to them and helpful.
So if the food's not very good, you can't complain?
Oh, you can complain, but there's a way to do it, and you're not very, yeah,
I'm
tact
not very
is the word.
I'm Okay.
And also, you can complain, but it's not their fault if the food's bad. They've not cooked it.
I don't complain that often. I mean, it really takes a lot to make me complain, because I always think if you complain about it and they take it away and bring it back, what's going to be in it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Someone's definitely spat in your food before. Yeah.
Here's your pasta, sir. Reheated. Okay. I think we should stop there.
Yeah.
Okay. But before we go, I think I've got some new members, exciting to tell you about. No, it's been really nice. We've had a few nice emails as usual, and not lots, but some new people have signed up to Patreon. And I'm getting close to releasing the quiz that I've created. I have to say, curating the clues has been a major job, even with the help of AI. So I've enlisted the help of Marco from Marco's Marillion Museum, who said he would help do some clues for me. He hasn't done any yet, but I know he will. And I've also had Fraser, who you've spoken to, does stuff for the web magazine. He's been really good, actually, helping with that. So it'll be ready soon.
There better be, or they'll be fired.
But yeah, so new members, we've got Nick Felmingham, and we've got Chaz McKenzie, Jeffrey Schulich. Sorry, Jeffrey, if I pronounced that wrong. Boris Spurnell, Barry Kelly. That name rings a bell. Another brother, or uncle for you. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Barry.
We're going to have all the Kellys signing up soon.
I mean, only two of them.
I know. Where's the rest of them?
Which is a bit crap considering there's six others.
I hope you're listening. we've got Paul Janowski and Steve G. And we've also got Malik, no surname, and Mark Ingle. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time. In early 2009, I received an unexpected call from David Stops. We had bumped into each other from time to time over the years, so I knew there were no hard feelings about the way we had once fired him in a manner akin to someone dumping an old sofa on the street. He knew about our crowdfunding success and thought that I might make a valuable contribution to a new organisation being formed to champion artists' rights and independence. Almost accidentally, Marillion had become an inspiration to a new generation of artists hoping to avoid the shackles of a major label deal and make it in this brave new world of the internet. He asked me not just to sign up, but also to join the board of directors. It was exciting being part of something that so many successful musicians had already committed to. I would be sitting at a table with Nick Mason, Pink Floyd, Ed O'Brien, Radiohead, Dave Rowntree, Blur, Billy Bragg, Fran Healy, Travis, Robbie Williams, and David's own act, Howard Jones, among others. It was quite the table. As well as David Stops, there were a number of heavyweight managers involved too. I felt completely out of my depth, trying to navigate the complicated world of copyright, the making available right, equitable remuneration, and neighbouring rights. It was like learning to read all over again, and we all know how I once struggled with that. Copyright alone was so complicated that even the so-called experts struggled with some aspects of it. The world was changing thanks to the advent of the internet, and as usual, the creators and artists were getting the thin end of the financial wedge. The Featured Artists Coalition, FAC, was formed to give artists a unified voice and a seat at the table when this new digital frontier land was getting carved up. As Nick Mason quipped at our first board meeting, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably on the menu. We had endless discussions about where the music business was headed, and one of the issues that concerned everyone was that some record labels were still trying to pretend that as far as recording contracts were concerned, nothing had changed. They continued to account to artists as if they were still making CDs and records, hitting them with all the associated costs, manufacturing, shipping, warehouse storage, breakages, etc. I was an early adopter of streaming, joining Spotify in February 2009, after it was recommended to me by Jake Shillingford, a singer turned lecturer at the Brighton Institute of Modern Music. Jake had invited me to give a talk to the students about autonomy in the music industry, following the success of our crowdfunding model.
Almost in spite of ourselves, Marillion had become famous for something other than our music. We had people beating a path to our door to find out how he did it. Tony Smith invited me to dinner to gauge whether it was something he could use with Genesis. As I told him, there was no big secret. If anything, he should just look to our fans. They were the reason for our crowdfunding success. Smith wasn't the only big hitter to come calling. Elton John even upped Tony Smith's dinner and offered Eric Nielsen a job. It seemed like the smart move to take it. Elton had a much bigger operation than we would ever have, with multiple artists on his Rocket label. We wished Eric well, but we couldn't quite shake him. He came back every 2 years to help Lucy organise the Marillion weekend at Port Zealand for a while. Streaming wasn't on most people's minds back then. It was downloads that had everyone's attention. I found the whole subject fascinating. I am a man who used to dismantle keyboards to relax, remember? And before long, I was totally on board and on the board of the FAC. Within a year, they had made me joint CEO along with Crispin Hunt. Clearly desperate. They had also suggested I should volunteer to stand for a seat on the board of PPL, Phonographic Performance Limited, in the upcoming elections. In 1934, our old label, EMI, clearly as much fun then as they were when we signed with them, took a coffee shop in Bristol to court for playing their records, or phonograms as they were known to the great and the good, in public without permission. Much to EMI's delight, the court ruled that public performance of records requires the permission of the copyright owner. Sensing an opportunity to make a quick buck, EMI and Decca formed PPL to collect and distribute the cash collected from this new performance license. Many years later, but possibly also in a coffee shop, some of the more astute artist managers cottoned on to this little wheeze and demanded a share. By then, all the labels were in on the PPL action, but keen to keep the spoils for themselves. There was an informal arrangement whereby, if an artist manager asked for a share, they would be written a check and sent on their way. Without wishing to bore you, don't look at me like that, the edited version of history is that in 1996, everything changed when the EU introduced a directive entitling performers, that's us, to an equitable share of this windfall, which the labels had been keeping to themselves for the best part of 70 years. Equitable remuneration doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, especially for someone like me with a latent stammer. But once I was on the PPL board, it became something of a watchword. For the record, and because I like saying it out loud, I was the first featured performer to get elected to the PPL board. Featured meaning somebody whose name or band name appears on an album cover, as opposed to a session musician or orchestra player. The learning curve was even steeper than at the FAC, but I embraced my new role. David Stops was invaluable with his expertise on the nuances of the Rome Convention of 1961 and the Copyright and Related Rights Regulations of 1996. My, how those four-hour meetings simply flew by. I remained on the PPL board for 11 years, with the kind of re-election winning streak Red Rum might have balked at, until I was finally defeated in 2020. I wasn't sad to go. I think I did my bit for performers' rights. It was somebody else's turn. Conversely, after a few years on the board of the FAC, I was becoming more and more disillusioned with how the organisation was being run. Among other things, there were funding relationships with companies like Google and Spotify that, considering what we were trying to achieve, didn't sit comfortably with me. Plus, there were internal power struggles within the FAC and between the FAC and the Music Managers Forum that would eventually result in both Crispin and I resigning from our roles in 2014. Saying that, I do still believe in the FAC. It's a much slicker proposition these days, and I fully support their aims and objectives. In the few years I was there, I learned a lot from the managers and artists I spoke to. Some, like Billy Bragg, had been smart and kept ownership of their copyrights, only licensing them to record companies for a few years, as opposed to the entire life of the copyright like we once did. Others, such as Pink Floyd, had successfully renegotiated their contracts to reflect the new digital landscape. One thing was becoming clearer, namely, how difficult it was to come by the exact details of those new digital deals. The bigger artists went to their respective record companies and secured more favourable terms for themselves, but almost invariably signed non-disclosure agreements so they couldn't tell anyone how they had done it or what the specific digital terms were. In this way, the labels divided and conquered their artists, handing out as little as possible to the musicians powerful enough to take them on, and next to nothing to the rest. A light went on. I wrote to EMI and told them they didn't have the right to make our music available for streaming because our contracts didn't cover it. EMI, being peak EMI, pretty much told me to fuck off. I couldn't do this alone. I wasn't a lawyer, and our recording contracts were long and complex. Also, there was more than one, the original 1982 contract and the 1991 we all signed after Fish left and H joined. Just to add to the hijinks, there was also a bunch of contracts entered into by Marillion Limited, Marillion Overseas Limited, and the various individual companies each member of the band owned in the mid-1980s. All of which we had allowed to be struck off the UK official register of companies in the early 90s, despite the fact that they held our performers' rights for the Fish era material, and unbeknownst to us, we were months away from being too late to resurrect. This would have meant saying goodbye to all our future royalties from albums like Misplaced Childhood. They would have gone directly into Queen Elizabeth's coffers. It was a mess, like dropping a jar of pasta sauce on a shag carpet is a mess, and it was going to take more than me to clean it up. Then, like a bolt from the blue, EMI went under, and my one-man crusade, I'd like to imagine I'd cut quite the figure sat astride a horse, to get a better deal for Marillion was temporarily put on hold. By chance, Pete mentioned to me that Guy Vickers, a fan of the band, who I was vaguely aware of, was a barrister. Interest piqued, I managed to meet Guy after a gig in San Francisco, where I casually asked if he could look at a few contracts for me. Luckily enough, he was willing to agree to meet for a drink in Amsterdam a few weeks later. Apart from a shared interest in contract law, people can't get enough of us at dinner parties. Or is it that people can't get away from us fast enough at dinner parties? I forget. We also discovered a mutual love of 1970s era Yes. We also agreed to disagree on whether the Drama album is crap. It's crap. Regardless, a friendship was forged over the next few years, as it took at least that long to conclude the work Guy had started on our behalf, which included restoring our companies to the register with weeks to spare and long enough for them to transfer our performers' rights to us as individuals. I will have to draw a discreet veil over how the business deal was precisely concluded, but suffice to say, we reached a satisfactory agreement with our catalogue's new owners, Warner Music. This resulted in us working together with Warner's on deluxe editions of our first 8 albums, starting with Misplaced Childhood in 2017. Guy and I also went on to collaborate creatively together a few years later. But more on that later. He's still wrong about Drama, though. In March 2010, while writing our 16th album, 17th if you count 2009's acoustic Less Is More album, we decided to decamp to a country house called Casa de Jute in Lousada, Portugal. There was a generous main room that normally functioned as a restaurant from which we cleared the furniture and replaced it with our equipment. Like school children fudging their homework, we had already put off this daunting task of knuckling down and writing our next album by spending most of 2009 reworking existing songs into new acoustic arrangements for a range of instruments we barely knew how to play. And by we, I mean me. I had gone with the autoharp and glockenspiel. I also had fun buying a real pipe organ on eBay for £200. It was an acoustic keyboard after all. And then I pissed the rest of the band off by setting it up in the studio. It blocked out any semblance of natural light and occupied a sizable chunk of space you could unwittingly walk into and quite hurt yourself at almost any time. Eventually, I gave up trying to tune it and offloaded it to an unsuspecting fellow progger, John Mitchell, for what I paid for it. I mentioned the daunting task of knuckling down to write again because we didn't feel quite ready to start again. The metaphorical cupboard was bare after the Somewhere Else and Happiness albums had used up practically everything we had. We arrived at Casa de Juste without H. Lynetta, his wife, was unwell, and he was naturally reluctant to leave her at home alone with their young child. The rest of us just got on with things. My wariness was misplaced. Working together again wasn't so bad after all. We were having fun jamming, and with the benefit of hindsight, I would say that the sort of music we were creating was on the classic end of the prog spectrum. You know, invented time signatures, odd chord progression, the sudden urge to wear a cape. Fun to play, hard to like or listen to, even harder to sing, I suspect. But who cared? We were blowing off steam. In the great Marillion tradition, whenever one of us is not in the room, he instantly becomes the main topic of conversation among the other remaining members. I distinctly remember walking into the studio at Racket once to a sudden hushed silence. It was an odd and awkward moment until it hit me. "You've been talking about me, you bastard." They all burst out laughing. I've no idea what they were saying, and I've no wish to know. Sometimes you just don't need to know. Naturally, H was one of the topics of conversation before he arrived in Portugal, not least a lyric he was working on and had tried a few times in previous writing sessions. The consensus was that none of us were that keen on it, and perhaps one of us should say something. For his part, H had reluctantly dragged himself away from home, conscious of the need not to waste the limited time in Portugal that we were paying for. The first day we tried making some music together, he looked at us the way I imagine early English explorers must have looked the first time they encountered hieroglyphics. Surprise, some consternation, but mostly puzzlement. Our prog wig-out was falling short of its mark. In no uncertain terms, he told us he didn't like it. It's moments like these when a man needs to take stock, look at the bigger picture, think of their friend who has just had to leave his ailing wife behind and make an unwanted journey. I'm not that man. Crap, I seem to recall saying. I'll tell you what's crap. And then quite possibly the subject of H's latest lyric might have raised its ugly head. To say H was furious is to understate it somewhat. He stormed out of the room, and I think he would have flown home that day had we not been booked to play a Less is More show at the Casa da Vila on the 27th of March. We didn't see a lot of him for the rest of the time in Lusada, and when we did, it was like bumping into an ex-girlfriend and her new beau. Awkward. Big mouth strikes again. We limped on to the end of our allotted time there, and while the sun shone brightly outside, the atmosphere between us remained somewhat frosty. Months of silence passed, with no hint if or when we might write or work together again. After braving years in the wilderness and finally getting back on track as a band, we had managed to run ourselves off the road one more time.